Today on Main Calling, finding Shakespeare in our daily lives. William Shakespeare is credited with completing 38 plays before he died at the age of 52. Now, more than 400 years later, his words are still studied, spoken, and staged all over the world. And his turns of phrase are repeated daily by all of us, whether we know it or not. What's so special about Shakespeare? And why does he still matter? I'm Keith Shortall, and today on the program we'll talk with a panel of scholars and performers who will help us find answers to those questions and learn more about the man who gave voice to Hamlet, Macbeth, Lear, Romeo, and Juliet, and who still speaks to us about joy, death, betrayal, despair, and love. As always, we want to hear from you, what Shakespeare has to say about the modern world. Main Calling is just ahead.
Main Calling is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Down East communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Main Calling. Few in the history of the written word have left such an indelible mark as did William Shakespeare. We quote him daily, whether we know it or not, and his works are brought to life on stages around the world. Today we're going to talk about why Shakespeare remains relevant, even vital, and find out more about some of the productions that are taking place in Maine this summer. For us with the hour is Caitlin Manfrey, board member at the Phoenix Theater Company and former humanities program coordinator at the Folger Shakespeare Library. She's also a former teaching artist for Shakespeare Theater Company. Stephen Legovietz is the producing artistic director of Camden Shakespeare Festival, which he founded in 2013. And Caroline Bix, Stephen E. King Chair in Literature at UMaine, author of several books about Shakespeare, and co-creator and co-host of the Everyday Shakespeare podcast. As always, we invite you to join the conversation. Do you have a favorite play? Do you find Shakespeare difficult to read? Email talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call. The number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. I want to begin by posing a premise, which you can challenge if you'd like, which is that how you feel about Shakespeare in the same way maybe how you feel about math or about classical music may depend in some part on how it was introduced to you, what your first impression was, the emotions that you felt when it was first brought to you. And Caitlin, I'm going to start with you on that question.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. So excited to be here. I love nothing more than to talk about Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. And I'm so excited to do so with this wonderful panel. I grew up in Southern New Hampshire, and I was very fortunate to have be part of a program in my middle school for kids who just really liked English class, really liked language arts, where instead of going to gym a few times a week, we'd get to go to this like special class where we did creative writing, we read short stories, and we always did a big Shakespeare unit. And it was mixed ages. It was outside of the realm of a typical curriculum. So our teacher would look up what productions were coming to Boston, to Concord, to the areas around us. And she would program those plays for us to read as a class. We would get up on our feet and read them. She'd bring in costume pieces and we'd talk through what was happening and what the characters were all about as we were going. And so to me, my first experience of Shakespeare was doing it, was performing it like in my class, up on my feet. And I was always a theater kid, but this is big. We were doing Merchant of Venice when I was 10 years old. So it was real. We were getting into some real stuff, but getting to connect it directly to performance and to then go see a production at the end of that unit, and see everything we talked about kind of brought to life on stage was I will say, invaluable. And I think connecting this work, connecting the words and the language to performance, it's how I feel it's how it was intended to be consumed, right? I mean, when Shakespeare was writing these plays, there was no publishing en masse. There was never the intention that it was going to be like read in school. It was popular entertainment. So it was, I think these plays are best experienced when you can see them, when you can get up on your feet, read them aloud, even with people or by yourself, just to give them life beyond the text on the page, I think brings everything out of them. It's
Well, I want to talk about re go ahead, we'll let you go to you Caroline in a second, but so you were lucky to have that, but many of us our introduction was in high school English class, and the book was a book was plopped down, and we each read sections of it and maybe didn't understand even what was going on in sections of it. So yeah, Carolina, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, to your point, I think unfortunately for a lot of people, their first introduction to Shakespeare really makes them feel alienated because they don't feel like they can understand the language. And usually that's introduced to students in the common curriculum somewhere in 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade. So I think it's really the teachers that make the big difference. I was really lucky to have teachers who were so passionate, middle school and high school teachers, passionate about the language. So while I absolutely agree with Caitlin that, yeah, you got to get it up on its feet. It was meant to be heard. It was meant to be seen. It wasn't meant to be read. I was fortunate to have teachers who really showed me the gorgeousness of the language and how hearing it as poetry can connect you to the meaning. It doesn't have to alienate you from the meaning, that the two really can mutually reinforce each other. So I also emphasize that when I teach it, because I teach Shakespeare every semester at the University of Maine, and most of my students have never seen a play, much less a Shakespeare play, so it's about trying to get them to appreciate and love and feel that they have some buy-in, that they have something to say and contribute. Because that's another big problem with Shakespeare. People think they have no right to say anything about it, right? Everything's not that about it, but there's always more to say about it. That's why Shakespeare endures. He knows how to speak to problems across ages, across time. He's really elastic.
When I was in high school, I think we only read Romeo and Juliet. However, Peter Brook had just done his landmark production of Midsummer Night's Dream, which many consider the most influential theater production of any kind, and not just Shakespeare. And what I didn't know at the time is that after that production was performed, Peter Brook actually published a play version which would show you how to do the play in the way that he did it. And it's hard to describe anything theatrical, but before that, Midsummer Night's Dream had not, it was always fairies with wings and the way you would think of them in the old 19th century paintings of fairies. But his production featured no forest, no wings. It was just a white box with characters who you could not even tell from their costume who they were. And a neighboring high school got this copy of How to Do Brooks' Midsummer Night's Dream. And the director of that show was an incredible director. And that was my first introduction to seeing a Shakespeare play in high school. And it was revelatory because it was first, like nothing I had ever seen, but the things seemed to have so much life and spontaneity, which is not what you think of when you're reading it. So that had a huge impression on me.
You're really lucky that was your first
That's
Shakespeare.
radical.
I'm sure there are no purists here among us, but there are those who say, look, we should, the play was written to be staged in this particular way with these costumes, and this is how it's done. Obviously, you have all have experience with expanding, I guess, the limits of that, and not only don't have a problem with it, but find it refreshing and interesting. Is there a big divide about this between, those who believe the work should be kept as close to what was staged 400 years ago?
Yeah, but what people don't understand is that when Shakespeare wrote the plays, they were all set in his contemporary era. The plays were done so fast, they only had one set of costumes, one queen costume, one king costume, and they used the same costumes for every play, even when they did something set 1,000 years before that, because the audience wanted a queen to look like what they expected a queen to look like. So all of his plays were set in the contemporary era, even ones that he wrote, even the Roman plays. So I think it's a mistake to think that that he didn't want them done in a contemporary setting.
And to think that there's only one text. because so many of these plays we have multiple versions of, even during Shakespeare's lifetime. A play like Hamlet, for example, there are two printed versions when Shakespeare's alive that are very different, that reflect probably very different performance contexts. I mean, these plays were not just statically, put up on stage at the Globe. They would move around depending on the time of year or the context or who's hiring them to do a special show. So Shakespeare would have understood if we took liberties.
Yeah. I don't know that I've, have you guys come across folks who think they should just be done in tights? I haven't come across that.
No, I when I taught Shakespeare classes and camps in DC for kids, they would often come first day, like I was teaching 9 to 11-year-olds a lot my first summer, and they'd come and they'd start asking if we had to do British accents and if we were going to wear big costumes. I was like, no, you will do this in your camp t-shirt, in your voice, and maybe we'll give you some wings, but otherwise it's all on you. And I think it speaks a lot to what we were talking about earlier, where it giving that ownership, giving that buy-in to every individual production. It's the reason we're still doing these plays, is because you can put them in every world, every context. You can make so many choices about them, and it's why it's so fun. And if you're going to do it in the Renaissance period, like, what story are you telling then? If you're going to do, you know what I mean? There's like, you can tease something out of it no matter where you set it.
I want to talk about the language, which was mentioned, which seems to me a kind of a double-edged sword, because the stories are timeless, the characters are timeless, the themes are timeless, but the language, the syntax, the references are all of a certain time, and can be a barrier with references to the classics that may not be understood. I think we know what we're talking about here. It's early modern English, but it's also the poetry. It's the beauty of that language. And so what's most compelling about it seems to be a barrier to some. How do you get at that? Are you against, translation, subtitles? Is it better just to teach people? Or do you think they get the gist of the play without understanding every word?
I think it depends. I'm sorry. I think it depends upon what line you're talking about. It's hard to make a blanket statement about everything that way. Certainly a famous speech, if you change something. When I directed Hamlet, I changed fardels to burdens, but it happened to be in the to be or not to be speech, and I got so many angry letters. How dare you change fardels to burdens? But I think it depends upon the individual passage. There are some things that the audience won't understand now, no matter how clear the actors are.
Yeah, but I would say, so I definitely am not a big fan of modernizing the language. If students are learning a play, I always say to them, stick with it. It's like learning a foreign language, but you can do it. Listen to it, watch it. So one of my favorite lines, I have so many favorite lines, but a line like when Juliet's describing her love for Romeo, right? She says, my bounty is as boundless as the sea, my love as deep. what's not to understand about that, you know? And bounty is boundless. You know, the poetry compounds and gives it its meaning. So at least I try to find those moments or highlight those passages that really show how the poetry is making the meaning come mm-hmm. to life, you know?
Yeah. And I also think it's up to a production to weigh that, right, for a modern audience. I directed last summer Love's Labor's Lost for the Shakespeare in the Park here in Portland. And that's a great play, kind of trapped inside of like a lot of really, really old linguistic and like just all these references and jokes and language and wordplay that like absolutely means nothing to a modern audience. And it's interesting to study probably in the context that you would teach at Caroline to like learn what those words mean and why those jokes are funny. But like if you're sitting there for 15 minutes and they're making a reference to a sheep joke, that it's bad.
Let me be clear. I have a lot of trouble doing the comedy part with the students. Yeah. I'm like, I can't explain why this was funny to them. I'm sorry. Humor is actually the one thing that I find really hard to translate.
Yeah. So I just cut it. I just cut it down. I found what could go, and I put together a more streamlined, clearer text. I didn't change any words. I just took out the stuff that didn't work. And I think that's, you know, it's up to productions to make that. Every director that sits down or every theater that's going to sit down and work on a Shakespeare play is going to take a look at that script and cut some stuff. It's like, rarely is the text being done completely as is or as published, for length, for clarity, for all the things.
Right. The opening of Romeo and Juliet begins with this complicated set of puns having to do with the word collar. And I don't know that anybody starts the play that way. You know, you want to get to the stuff and there's plenty of things in that opening scene that people will understand without a problem, but I don't know that anyone starts it that way.
Right. Yeah.
I have a history question here about the confluence here of the printing of the King James Bible and Shakespeare's works, which were all, you know, sort of at the same time. But what's the significance of that, or is there any, in terms of the language itself and how it was popularized, how it was sent around the English-speaking world?
Do you know that? Do you guys know that great little thing about the Psalms in the King James Bible? So this is somebody's idea that Shakespeare had a hand in at least looking at the text, that when the King James Bible came out when Shakespeare was 46, and if you look at only that version, the King James Version, in the 46th Psalm, the 46th word from the beginning is shake, and the 46th word from the end is spear. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's true, but it's really fun to think about.
It is true. I mean, I've gone down that conspiracy rabbit hole. It is true. And, you know, I mean, that version of the Bible came out in 1611. Mm-hmm. Shakespeare dies in 1616. So, I mean, I don't know if there was any way he would have had a hand in any of the writing of the Bible. That's not my expertise. But I wouldn't be surprised. And also, we have to think about Shakespeare's plays maybe influencing the people who were writing the Bible. You know, maybe they heard or read one of his poems, one of his sonnets, and was influenced to write the Bible in a particular way, a passage.
Yeah. And something we were talking about, you know, the globalization of the world that was happening with England, you know, the expansion of the English language, the trade routes, all of it. I mean, what folks were bringing around to the English speaking world from England were the Bible and Shakespeare's plays in the years that followed the publishing of the first folio. And so I think that's there's a reason why the world has Shakespeare and has had Shakespeare for so long, because it traveled at a time when mass production of books was so brand new. But Shakespeare's plays were among the first to be collected and published like that, and certainly some of the first pieces of drama. And the size of the body of work we have of him really kind of out outclasses a lot of his contemporaries. Just in we have so many plays and so many poems and all of these sonnets and all of these other, like, the so there, it just goes on and on. And that was moving around the world as the as England was expanding and the English colonialism was happening.
We're going to take a quick break. Join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. We are talking today about Shakespeare. My guests, Caitlin Manfrey, board member of the Phoenix Theater Company and former humanities program coordinator at the Folger Shakespeare Library. Stephen Legovyets is the producing artistic director of Camden Shakespeare Festival, which he founded in 2013. And Caroline Bix, the Stephen E. King Chair in Literature at UMaine and co-host of the Everyday Shakespeare podcast. Share your comments and questions. Email talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or on Instagram, or just give us a call. The number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. I do have someone who has, we had a caller who couldn't stay on the line, but asked the panel whether the panel agrees that whether Shakespeare really wrote all of the plays he's credited with writing. And yeah, Caitlin, go ahead.
I do love this question. I'm sure, Caroline, you probably have a much more scholarly take, but just as someone who's like, who's read and performed and worked on a lot of this work, these plays, when you read them side by side, you see the evolution of one person as a writer. You see the evolution of an artist. I wish I had the passages in front of me, but I remember in graduate school reading Romeo and Juliet and then a few weeks later reading Richard III and seeing like almost line for line, like the same couple passages. Clearly he had worked on one. He liked kind of like the way it sounded. And then he brought it back for Romeo and Juliet. I mean, we may never know, right? But I think it was one person. I think it was this guy. I see no reason. I mean, I know that there's compelling arguments in lots of ways, but I definitely see as you read and you work through this text, the evolution of one artist.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the issue about, well, it couldn't have been this guy from Stratford-on-Avon who didn't go to university, is speaking to an elitism around, you know, who gets to be a genius. So we have plenty of evidence about Shakespeare, the man from Stratford-on-Avon, who was owned his theater, co-owned his theater, was an actor, was a playwright. We have plenty of references from the time period people are making about Shakespeare, the playwright. Yeah. So I have no doubt that he's the man.
Okay. And we won't get... Yeah, go ahead.
No, that's it. Yeah.
Oh, okay. We won't get into whether he smoked marijuana. That came up, of course, in the research. We're trying to bring in a call. I'm not sure we have it. But in the meantime, we'll keep it here. How would you assess Shakespeare's popularity at the time he was writing? He was not... I'd read in some takes that he was better known as a poet than as a playwright, or that many of the most popular stage productions at the time were not his, so that he wasn't sort of a superstar in the era. How would you characterize his standing then? And then we can go on from there to talk about maybe why he emerged as such an important force.
Go ahead. Well, I don't know that that's true. I think there's a lot of evidence that his plays were very popular. His company had the patronage of the king, and so I have not. Certainly when he started out, the folks who had been writing plays looked down on him, but I feel like all of his plays, as evidenced maybe by how many pirated copies of the text there ended up being, were very popular.
Yeah, and some of the plays that they published during his lifetime put his name on the front. So it was enough of a selling point to say this was written by William Shakespeare to have people buy it. But you're right. I mean, his first bestseller was Venus and Adonis, which is an epic poem that an Apulian. So he was first known as a poet, but certainly people knew him as a playwright. And again, he was enough of a marketing tool to, you know, it was worth putting his name on the cover when he was alive, you know, when they were selling the plays.
And what Caitlin said earlier is right. This was, if I may use this phrase, it was the television of its day, that this was the popular entertainment. You could see a play for the price of a beer, and it was not, there was no barrier to seeing these plays. They were not super expensive, and everyone went. That is a time, it's really remarkable that there was the entire spectrum of the British class system in one building at one time watching a play, which is not the case today.
True.
All right. I'm going to go try to do the phones. The phones are acting a bit weird, but I want to see who we have on the line now. Hi, are you there?
Hi, I'm Julie from 10 Bucks Theater Company.
Oh, hi, Julie. Great. Well, thanks for coming on. I was going to talk to you a little bit later in the program, but we'll talk to you now since you're here. So 10 Bucks has been around now for more than 20 years, right? And you primarily centered in the Bangor area. And I'd seen in your materials that you have included Shakespeare in at least one production every season.
Yep, we've been doing, we turned 25 this year. We're a small community theater here in Bangor. And we've been doing Shakespeare since 2004. We perform in Indian Trail Park in Brewer. And in 2010, we also started taking the shows to Fort Knox in Prospect.
Yeah. So are you sort of the only Shakespeare company operating in that region? Or
yes. Yep. Camden also does it, but up in the Bangor area, we are known for doing Shakespeare.
Yeah. And how is it received? How would you assess, you know, how the community responds?
Overall, we've been very pleased. Of course, you know, we always look for more, to how to grow our audiences, et cetera. It's incredibly well received at Fort Knox. We're very pleased with that. We love that venue. And it's interesting to go from a park with trees to then being in a stone fort. It makes for interesting adjustments.
Yeah, it's a dramatic setting. It's Fort Knox, really great. So
yes.
Tell us about what you're staging this summer.
We are doing A Midsummer Night's Dream. This, in our history of doing Shakespeare, this will be the third time that we've offered Midsummer. Last time was in 2012. And we're doing it this summer because, you know, it's his most famous comedy. People love it. And I think given some of the tough political climate, et cetera, we just wanted to do something absolutely fun and that people can enjoy and don't have to think about too much.
Right. And when does that go to stage?
We open in Indian Trail Park on July 17th and run through the 27th, and we run Thursdays through Sundays, and then we take it to Fort Knox on July 31st through August 3rd.
Okay.
All shows started. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Julie, thank you. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
I was just going to say all shows start at 6 p.m.
All right. Julie Arnold-Lisnett is with 10 Bucks Theater. Thank you so much for joining us. Julie mentioned doing something, you know, lighter fare. Maybe it's a good time to talk about this. When we talk about, Shakespeare is often considered this very high-minded by some, wrongly, you know, it's all Hamlet, it's all Macbeth, it's all very heavy and about death, but it's really a, I mean, he writes about an enormously, the complete range of the human condition and human emotions. And how do you, I guess, well, let's just talk about that first of all. It's sort of remarkable. Many writers will stick to sort of one thing they do well. He really touched it all.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's something for everybody. and I will say, I mean, to that point that you were making earlier, Macbeth is super fun. There's witches, there's bloody ghosts. There's kind of a lot happening in there that is very pulpy. And it was, as Stephen was saying, it was popular entertainment. King James, who he wrote that play for, like loved the occult, was like kind of weirdly obsessed with the occult and dark arts. And so he wrote this play to like please the king. And so it's full of all this dark magic, and it's very fun and spooky, and you can do a lot with productions of Macbeth that, so it doesn't feel as heavy. It's also really short. And Romeo and Juliet is a comedy until it's not. Like, it's really, it is very funny for the first, whatever, half. He does a really, I mean, even within the plays that are considered tragedies, there's so much levity. There's so much humor. Yeah. And I think, I mean, the wide range that, I mean, there really is, like, there's a role for every kind of actor. There is something to explore every time you come back to a part. I mean, the breadth of the work is incredible, and it's why we keep coming back, I think, because it's not just one thing.
Yeah, and he...
Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say that the tragedies all have a clown, you know? so he understood that, you know, the human experience is joyous and tragic. You can hit the highs and the lows all in one story. Mm-hmm. You bring a clown to the party when it's a tragedy and when it's a comedy.
Yeah.
Because the clown is a truth speaker, right? And he can say things in a way that, you know, to Julie Lisnett's point, and everyone should go see the $10 Theater. It's phenomenal. You know, the point that sometimes we're not ready to stomach particularly serious matter, but that doesn't mean we can't get at serious topics through comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Example. So that sometimes it's a way for us to process things that are too traumatic to take head on.
Yeah, he wrote in every genre, and comedy, drama, history, horror, fantasy, fairy tale. But I also like Harold Bloom's idea that every single play defies genre. Mm-hmm. That there is something unexpected in every play, and you can't. The moment you want to put it in a category, you find 10 things that is not in that category. And that's what makes his plays so rich.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a lot of them are really hard to actually define. There's a bunch of plays that are considered comedies that kind of like really aren't. And they leave you with a strange feeling at the end. That's not, you know, just like we're happy. And those are, so we just have, they've made up categories over the years, the problem plays, the, you know, whatever. It's like, right.
The romances, you know.
Right.
Yeah, he was
right. I just watched All's Well That Ends Well, which is a comedy,
favorite.
And there, and I have to think that title is sarcastic.
Oh yeah,
you know,
there's nothing good about that ending. Nobody's happy at the end of that end of that play, and I think there's a reason that one has had the most troubled history in terms of there's no Hollywood All's Well That Ends Well. there should be.
All right, yeah. And we'll talk more about that, but we're going to take another quick break. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the show, where to find a production of a play by Shakespeare this summer, and why his works remain so powerful today. My guests are Caroline Bix, English professor at UMaine, co-author of Shakespeare Not Stirred, Cocktails for Your Everyday Dramas, and co-creator and co-host of the Everyday Shakespeare podcast. Caitlin Manfrey is a board member at the Phoenix Theater Company in Portland and former Humanities Program Coordinator at the Folger Shakespeare Library. She's also a former teaching artist for Shakespeare Theater Company. And Stephen Legovyets is the producing artistic director at Camden Shakespeare Festival, which he founded in 2013. He's directed and curated over 100 professional productions and has been directing Shakespeare since 1988. Join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. We'll go to the phones in a moment. But we were talking before the break about different productions and what are maybe harder to do. What would you say is the most, maybe this is the wrong question, but most challenging Shakespeare play to produce, and then, and why? Stephen, I'll start with you.
Well, challenging from the point of view of the, that's a lot of different ways you could go about that. So, for example, Timon of Athens, which almost no one does, is challenging because you could do it, but I don't know that you'd get a large audience. If you're talking about, you know, Lear is challenging because the level of acting is so profound in that play that in order for it to have a chance of it succeeding, you have to have extraordinary actors. So there's, you know, different ways to think of why a play might be challenging.
Yeah.
Caitlin? I always say that the histories feel the hardest, only because there's so much that we as Americans don't know about the nuances of English history and the lineage and the right of kings. And there's like, and there's so much in there that that I feel like I would find particularly challenging to a contemporary American audience. And and productions, I mean, there are productions, obviously, that are done, and there's some great plays, there's some beautiful language, there's some wonderful characters, and there's witches and in there too, but it's like it's, you have to get past like, why are we all fighting the War of the Roses? And we have to know that, and there's a lot that I think is assumed knowledge, would have been assumed knowledge of Shakespeare's audiences, that we just absolutely do not have the context for today.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, that's a great point. I agree with that.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. We'll bring in Kat, who is calling from Midcoast Shakespeare. Hi, Kat, welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Sure. I'll ask the same question of you. Well, first of all, tell us about Midcoast Shakespeare.
Sure. So Midcoast Shakespeare Studio is a new theater studio that was founded just earlier this year. We kind of opened our doors in March. And we're a place that is a sort of resource to our local area, also sort of finding our place among all the other wonderful festivals, celebrations, theater troupes, performing art troupes all around Midcoast. And so we came here to do some more Shakespeare.
So where are you based?
We're based in Belfast, Maine. We're right at the Belfast Center, just close to downtown Belfast. And we're doing our first production is going to be this summer. We're doing a summer Shakespeare festival, partnering with Belfast Parks and Rec. And we're offering a production of Twelfth Night free to the public at Belfast City Park. So it should be a really fun time. And we'll be having some sort of festival activities during the day on Saturday, August 2nd, as well as other live performances and live music happening that week.
All right, Kat, well, congratulations on your beginnings, and thank you for checking in. Twelfth Night panel is it's a crowd pleaser, right? It's a good one to kick things off with. Can you just talk a little bit about why?
I think Twelfth Night is like one of the best ensemble comedies he wrote. There's like all of the parts carry equal weight. People love it. It's very fun. It's very funny. I think I have like so many personal theories about it and how it speaks to censorship and the censorship that Shakespeare and the artists of his day were experiencing. But we don't have to get into that. But yeah, I mean, Phoenix Theater Company that I am on the board for has done a wonderful holiday production for the last couple of years here in Portland. And they've because it was, it's called Twelfth Night. It was probably written for the Epiphany, the 12 days of, you know, the 12th day of Christmas, about misrule and all of that. And they've plugged like 20 plus holiday songs into the production. So taken, you know, all the space that there is for music in that play, and put in contemporary and traditional holiday classics. And it's been really, that's been a really fun show. So hopefully we'll bring that back in the next couple seasons.
And it's a great mix of dark and light, and you can emphasize the light or emphasize the dark, but both of those things travel on parallel pathways, which is another thing that makes it such a brilliant play. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do any of you, you had mentioned, Caitlin, sort of these plays make you think about, you know, in some cases, politics. But I'm wondering, in your everyday lives, do any of you like instantly conjure up Shakespeare, a quote, a passage when you're reading the news in the morning? I mean, does it, does it just come up?
Yeah.
And there was, in the last few years, when all of the things about Me Too were in the news, I just kept remembering that scene from Measure for Measure with Angelo and Isabella, where Angelo says, "I'll save your brother's life if you sleep with me." And Isabella says, "Not only won't I sleep with you, I'm going to tell everyone what you said." And Angelo says, "Who would believe you? I'm rich and powerful and you're nothing." And that just kept bouncing back and forth in my mind from the time that all of those news stories came out. And the fact that Shakespeare made that observation 400 years ago just demonstrates this, that it's an ongoing issue.
Let's bring in, I do need to bring in Dawn McAndrews, producing artistic director at the theater at Monmouth. Dawn, thanks for waiting.
Absolutely.
So Monmouth has Shakespeare in its very DNA, right? You've been staging works for a long time, and it was part of its origin.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, it's kind of in our charter to do two Shakespeare's, definitely in the summer, and then surround ourselves with other classic plays, and lately even some contemporary ones as well.
So, and what is your philosophy of staging productions? Are you into innovation? Are you traditionalist? Just tell us how you go at it.
We definitely try to be innovative and really try and find ways to bring Shakespeare's plays into our current situation. So several years ago, we did a series of productions that ended up having some really contemporary resonance. So we try to keep Shakespeare alive by, we may cut plays like some of the other panelists have been discussing for time, for clarity. And we also take Shakespeare out on the road once a year to schools and community venues throughout the state.
And so what's on for this summer?
So this summer, well, actually, you've been talking about it a bunch. We're actually doing a production of Twelfth Night. The director has set it loosely in the 60s. So there's a little bit more vibe in terms of the underscoring and the music and the costumes. So it feels contemporary, but it's very much keeping to the original intent of Shakespeare.
Yeah, well, thank you. Go ahead.
We're also going to be doing Cymbeline, which isn't often produced, And similarly, that is actually going to be done a little bit more in its original time period. And then we have two other productions, Ms. Holmes and Ms. Watson in Apartment 2B, and The Complete Works of Jane Austen Abridged. We found that the adjacent plays really lift up the Shakespeare and give us an opportunity to bring in younger audiences.
Great. Don McAndrews, thank you so much. And I apologize for the long wait there on the phone. To callers, we have been having some technical difficulties with the telephone, so we beg your forgiveness and thank you for your patience. We're happy to get a few folks on. Don McAndrews, producing artistic director at the Theater of Monmouth. I want to ask our panelists, too, about productions they're involved in coming up this summer. Caitlin, do you want to go first?
Sure. So Phoenix Theater Company is producing our 17th summer of free Shakespeare in Deering Oaks Park in Portland. This year we're doing As You Like It. So another comedy. And I loved what the folks at 10 Bucks Theater said about like wanting to do something light and fun and warm in this current challenging time we're living in. And that is a lot of the ethos behind this production of As You Like It. It's one of I think it's my favorite of the comedies. It's a beautiful romantic comedy story with a ton of music. So there'll be 10 actors playing 19 roles and a host of instruments, including trumpet, harmonica, guitar, mandolin, drums, you name it. And they're going to be, it's going to be soundtracked with contemporary music from the 1960s to today. So it'll be a lot of fun. It'll be it's a beautiful setting for a summer evening in a play that primarily takes place in the woods to be doing amongst the trees. All performances, it actually opens tonight, July 10th at 6:30 PM and runs, Thursday through Saturday, with the exception of 1 week where there's a Wednesday and not a Saturday, through August 7th. All product performances are at 6:30 p.m. in Deering Oaks Park in Portland. And you can find out more information, reserve your free tickets, learn about the cast at Phoenix Theater. That's F-E-N-I-X, theater with an R-E .com.
Yep. Right. Stephen, we've got about a minute or so left.
Okay. So Camden Shakespeare Festival is presenting The Two Gentlemen of Verona. We run for 4 weeks. We do 16 performances in Camden over that time period. It's July 16th through August 10th. You can find information at camdenshakespeare.org. We're in the beautiful Camden Amphitheater, one of the most beautiful places to perform in the state, of which there are many beautiful places. That play is a really funny early play of Shakespeare's. It is a comic love triangle, and there's a dog. And we're also adding about 10 70s R&B songs that are performed live in that. So it's really going to be fun. So please come out.
Great.
CamdenShakespeare.org.
All right. And seems like there's a lot going on. We could keep talking about whether we need more productions of Shakespeare and accessibility to it, but we're out of time, and we did want to share some of those productions that we could. So get out and get some Shakespeare. Thank you all for joining me today. Interesting hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stephen Legovietz is the producing artistic director of Camden Shakespeare Festival, which he founded in 2013. Caroline Bix is the Stephen E. King Chair in Literature at UMaine and has written several books about Shakespeare. And Caitlin Manfrey is a board member at the Phoenix Theater Company and former humanities program coordinator at the Folger Shakespeare Library. Today's sound engineer was Jane Donahue. Main Calling is produced by Cindy Hahn and Jonathan Smith. And you can visit maincalling.org for our audio archives and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. I'm Keith Shortall. This has been Main Calling. Thanks for listening.